How often do you find yourself swinging wildly between like two complete extremes?
Oh, all the time. It's so common.
Right. Like on one side, you're chasing a feeling, maybe looking for a way to numb out. You're completely leaning into indulgence just to escape the pressure of your week.
Yeah, just looking for that release.
Exactly. But then, you know, the inevitable consequences of that catch up with you. The guilt sets in. And so you swing the pendulum entirely in the opposite direction.
You go right to the other extreme.
Yeah. Suddenly you're punishing yourself,
Yeah.
enforcing this really harsh, grim, white-knuckling self-discipline, and just makes you absolutely miserable.
It is a profoundly exhausting way to operate. I mean, truly, we constantly bounce between those two walls. And we're operating under this illusion that those are our only two choices, you
Oh,
know?
like it's the binary.
Exactly. We believe we either have to, well, let go of the steering wheel entirely and crash, or clamp down so mercilessly on ourselves that life just loses all its joy.
Right. And that exhaustion, that constant feeling of being trapped in a pendulum swing, is exactly what we are tackling in today's deep dive.
It's such an important topic.
It really is. So we're looking at chapter 56 from the RAFT program. And our mission today is to explore what the text calls the middleway program.
Right.
We're going to figure out how to navigate daily life in a way that actually reduces harm and increases your freedom, but without demanding that you become some kind of joyless robot.
Yeah, because nobody wants that.
Yeah.
To ground ourselves first, though, we should probably establish where this chapter sits within the broader architecture of the RAFT program.
Good idea.
So RAFT is an acronym. It stands for Recognize, Abandon, Feeling, and Train.
Got it.
The earlier phases of this framework, they're largely about orientation. They help you know, build a map of your internal
We're
landscape.
figuring out where you are.
Exactly. And understanding how raw experience enters your awareness through your senses.
Okay, let's unpack this. If the earlier parts of the acronym are about making a map and recognizing the terrain, where exactly does chapter 56 fit in?
This chapter sits firmly in the train phase, so you
Okay.
can have the most detailed, beautifully illustrated map in the world.
But you still have to sail the boat.
Right. Eventually, you have to actually sail the vessel. This chapter is literally the operating manual for the voyage.
Ah,
It's
yeah.
about what you physically and mentally do on, like, a Tuesday morning when the alarm goes off, your inbox is totally overflowing, and the urge to fall back into old, harmful habits hits you like a tidal wave.
So what does this middle way actually look like when the pressure is on? Because I have to be honest, when I hear the phrase middle way, I instinctively recoil a little bit.
Really? How come?
It just sounds like a lukewarm compromise. Like you're just settling for being mediocre at both extremes.
Oh, yeah. That is probably the most common and honestly most damaging misconception. The middle way has a very specific historical origin.
Right. From the Gautama.
Yes, it was discovered by Gautama the Buddha. And he did not present it as a compromise or, you know, watering down of experience.
Okay.
It's a robust, highly active third option. It involves utilizing desire as a form of forward energy without letting it hold you hostage.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and employing discipline as a supportive architecture rather than a weapon you use to just beat yourself up.
I appreciate that framing. I really do, but I still have a conceptual hurdle here, I think.
Sarah, what is it?
Well, when people talk about Gautama in the middle way, it's almost always referred to as the Eightfold Path. And words like path or steps, they trigger something in my brain.
Like it's a rigid progression.
Exactly. I picture this rigid vertical ladder. I feel like I have to perfectly master step one before I'm even allowed to glance at step two. It feels incredibly linear and honestly intimidating.
That makes total sense.
So what if we looked at it less like a ladder and more like an ecosystem in a garden?
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, like you have soil, water, sunlight, and earthworms. They're all doing completely different jobs, but they rely entirely on each other to make the garden survive.
What's fascinating here is that historically, a lot of institutions did treat these teachings like a rigid ladder, and that caused immense frustration for people trying to practice them.
I can imagine.
But the RAFT program deliberately strips away that linear rigidity. Your garden analogy is actually much closer to the original intent of the text.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the program explicitly describes this as an ecology rather than a checklist. These are living skills that operate simultaneously.
So they feed into each other.
Precisely. Cultivating one naturally fertilizes the others. If you neglect the soil, well, the sunlight doesn't matter. They keep each other in balance.
That makes the barrier to entry feel so much lower. You don't have to be perfect at the bottom rung, you just have to start tending to the garden.
And that pragmatic approach really comes down to how we translate the ancient concepts. In the original Pali language, the word used to describe these eight skills is sama. Yeah. And for centuries in the West, sama has been translated as right, right view, right action, right effort.
Which immediately injects a heavy dose of moral judgment into the whole process.
Exactly.
If there's a right way, there must be a wrong way. Which brings us right back to feeling guilty and punishing ourselves.
Which is precisely why the RAFT program uses a different translation. They translate sama as skillful.
Oh, wow. That shift in vocabulary changes the entire landscape.
Doesn't it? It moves the concept from the realm of cosmic judgment into the realm of practical physics.
How so?
Well, think about it. If you're trying to build a table, using a hammer to drive a screw isn't morally evil.
Right, you aren't a bad person for doing it.
Exactly. It's just unskillful. It creates a mess. Skillful means looking at the situation in front of you, assessing the conditions, and choosing the tool that leads away from harm. It's entirely dynamic.
The RAFT program really leans into that practicality, too. They bring in secular Dharma teacher Stephen Batchelor.
Yes, his work is so relevant here.
He has this framework he calls the cartography of care. And he takes these somewhat mystified ancient concepts and translates them into the language of a modern Tuesday afternoon.
It grounds them.
Totally. Instead of mystical sounding states, he talks about cultivating mindfulness, collectedness, perspective, imagination, application, survival, work, and voice.
By replacing a term like right livelihood with a word like survival or work, Batchelor forces us to look at how we actually sustain ourselves in the real world.
Yeah, he strips away the religious creed entirely. His argument is that this dharma, this teaching, is just a provisional tool.
It's not a dogma.
Right, it's not a belief system you have to swear allegiance to. You use it to build a sturdier mind, you revise your approach as you learn what works for you, and when the tool has done its job, you put it down.
You don't have to carry the hammer around for the rest of your life.
Exactly.
Tools require a system to be effective, though. To prevent us from drifting back into compulsion or smashing against the rocks of our own harsh discipline, our raft needs distinct functioning parts.
Like the different jobs in the garden.
Right. So the program organizes these eight skills into three broad strands of training.
Let's get into those strands. The first one is wisdom.
Yes.
And in the context of our raft, wisdom is the navigator. And a navigator needs two specific tools, skillful perspective and skillful intention.
That's right.
The text describes skillful perspective as a commitment to realism, specifically acknowledging that our actions have inescapable consequences.
Which is harder than it sounds.
Definitely. The phrase that jumped out at me was that this perspective cures the fantasy of unconscious personal exceptionalism.
Oof, that is a very pointed
It
phrase.
really hits here.
Most of us operate with a quiet, subconscious belief that the laws of cause and effect apply to everyone else. But somehow, we possess a special exemption.
Yeah, like the rules don't apply to us.
We secretly believe we can routinely skip sleep, fuel ourselves on anxiety, treat the people around us poorly when we're stressed, and somehow miraculously avoid the physical and emotional fallout.
It's the belief that I can sail my raft directly into a jagged reef and somehow my boat won't splinter.
Exactly.
Skillful perspective is the navigator looking at the map and saying, you know, the laws of physics apply to you too. If you hit the rocks, you will sink.
And once that realism sets in, it naturally shapes your skillful intention. Intention is the direction of your heart.
The underlying motive.
Yes, it's the motive that steers the vessel. When you truly accept that harmful actions damage your own life, your internal resolve naturally shifts away from craving and resentment.
You stop wanting to crash the boat.
Right. You begin to actively steer toward harmlessness and letting go. It ceases to be an intellectual exercise and becomes the actual force moving the rudder.
But a navigator with a map and a rudder isn't enough if the boat itself is falling apart.
No, it's not.
Which brings us to the second strand,
Yeah.
ethics. If wisdom is the navigator, ethics is the compass and the crew. This strand encompasses skillful speech, skillful action, and skillful livelihood.
And we really need to apply the same pragmatic lens to the word ethics that we apply to right.
I'm glad you brought that up, because ethics usually sounds like a rigid code designed to make you a morally superior person.
Like a purity test.
Exactly. But in this framework, ethics are presented as incredibly practical guardrails. Let me try an analogy here.
Go for it.
Imagine trying to build mental discipline and peace of mind without having your ethics in check. Here's where it gets really interesting. It would be like mounting a massive state-of-the-art outboard motor onto a raft that is riddled with holes.
You can rev that engine as loudly as you want, but the structural integrity of the vessel is compromised. In
Exactly.
fact, the power of the engine might just pull the boat underwater faster.
Yes. Think about the real-world cognitive load of unskillful behavior. If you lie to cover up a mistake or you snap viciously at a coworker because you're stressed, you instantly generate a massive storm of inner noise.
You create fear of being caught, lingering guilt, defensive arguments in your head.
And you can sit on a meditation cushion for 3 hours trying to find peace, but your mind is chaotic because your actions are constantly generating fresh chaos. Self-sabotage.
Exactly. Ethics aren't about being a good person for the sake of an audience. They are about protecting the baseline clarity of your own mind.
And you are describing the exact bridge to the third strand, which is mental discipline. This is the stability of the vessel.
The balance.
Right. Even with a brilliant navigator and a clean, reliable crew, the ocean of daily life is fundamentally unpredictable. The winds will howl.
They always do.
This strand includes skillful effort, skillful mindfulness, and skillful collectedness.
Break those down for me because those terms get thrown around a lot in like wellness culture.
They do. So skillful effort is the sustainable energy required to encourage helpful mental states and gently starve unhelpful ones.
Okay.
It's not forcing, it's tending, like your garden analogy.
Ah, right.
Skillful mindfulness is the watchkeeper. It's the part of your awareness that simply notices the wave hitting the boat without immediately panicking or declaring that the voyage is ruined.
Just observing. Yeah. And skillful collectedness is the ballast. It's that heavy, gathered steadiness deep in the hull that prevents the raft from capsizing when a sudden squall hits.
Okay, so the clean hull of ethics allows the ballast of collectedness to actually do its job. I am tracking the logic here.
It's a very tight system.
And it is, but I have to play devil's advocate for a second. We're analyzing a framework developed by Gotama thousands of years ago. Does this ancient philosophy actually hold up when we examine it through the lens of modern science? I mean, we know infinitely more about the physical structure of the brain today.
It maps onto modern neuroscience with startling accuracy, actually.
Really?
Yeah. We used to think of willpower as a single muscle that you could flex.
Mm.
We now know the brain is a complex web of interacting networks.
Okay.
You have systems for executive function and reflection, and you have primitive systems for threat detection and habit formation. When a person falls into a compulsion, when they're caught in that wild pendulum swing, their neural systems literally fragment.
What does that fragmentation actually look like in a real scenario?
Think about the urge to doom scroll on your phone at 1:00 a.m.
Yes.
You know you have to be awake at 6 a.m. for a critical meeting. In that moment, your threat and habit loops are running incredibly hot.
You're just seeking that hit.
Right. The primitive parts of your brain are seeking immediate dopamine to soothe an underlying anxiety. Meanwhile, your prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain responsible for long-term planning and reflective choice, has effectively gone offline.
It's just shut down.
You are operating on a fragmented autopilot.
You know it's a bad idea, but the part of your brain that cares about tomorrow is asleep at the wheel.
Exactly the issue. What the Middle Way program does is train these separate neural systems to communicate and integrate.
How does it do that?
The wisdom strand forces the executive function to turn back on by analyzing long-term consequences. The ethics strand engages your social and empathic circuitry, reconnecting you to how your actions affect your environment. And the mental discipline strand physically downregulates the amygdala, reducing your threat reactivity. The practice takes a brain that is at war with itself and builds a cooperative system.
That biological mechanism makes total sense, and it ties directly into the psychology of motivation, specifically self-determination theory, which the RAFT program highlights.
Yes, that's a crucial piece.
If you're trying to change a harmful, repeating loop in your life, the source of your motivation dictates whether you'll succeed or collapse.
Right.
If you are driven by guilt, fear, or profound shame, psychology labels that controlled motivation.
This voice in your head screaming, "I must stop doing this, or I'm a terrible person."
But the mechanism of controlled motivation is self-defeating. Guilt and shame require a massive amount of psychological energy to maintain.
They burn so hot.
They burn incredibly hot and leave you totally depleted. And what does the brain do when it feels exhausted and depleted?
It violently craves relief.
Exactly. It seeks out the very numbing behavior you were using shame to try and stop. It's a closed trap.
Which is why the harsh, grim self-discipline always inevitably swings back to indulgence. The RAFT program short-circuits that trap by shifting the practitioner to autonomous motivation.
You want to do it.
Yes. You aren't practicing these skills because a cosmic judge is threatening you. You practice them because you genuinely, deeply care about the steadier, quieter life you are constructing.
That's a huge shift.
You want the stability. The fuel source changes from fear to care.
And stepping back to look at the historical context, it's fascinating how this ancient Eastern framework shakes hands with Western philosophy. The text brings up Aristotle's concept of the golden mean.
Oh, yes.
Aristotle argued that true virtue is never just a bland mathematical average between two extremes. It's about finding the perfect, precise fit for a specific situation.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, a great example of the golden mean is courage. Courage is not simply being 50% terrified and 50% reckless.
Right.
Courage is the precise, skillful response to a dangerous situation based on your actual capabilities. The middle way trains us to respond to the reality of our lives with that exact kind of precision.
The RAFT program also touches on existentialism, which feels almost aggressive compared to the rest of the text.
It can feel that way, yeah.
The existentialists believed that existence precedes essence. Meaning, we don't have a fixed, unchangeable identity. We are nothing more than the sum of our actions. We become what we repeatedly choose to do.
It is a bracing philosophy. It strips away all our excuses. But when paired with the middle way, it becomes incredibly empowering.
How so?
Because freedom is not a sudden mood that descends upon you from the sky.
Right.
Freedom is a structure you actively build, log by log, choice by choice.
Okay, so we've covered the neuroscience, the psychology, and the philosophy, but I want to know how this actually moves and breathes in a normal day.
In practice.
Yeah. The text introduces the concept of the living loop. The idea is that you're not expected to execute all eight of these skills perfectly at the same time.
Oh, of course not.
You make a microscopic shift in one area, and it alters the physics of the next area.
Because they're an ecology, a change in the soil changes the plant. Let's trace the causality of that loop. Imagine waking up deeply frustrated and overwhelmed.
We've all been there.
Right. If you simply pause and access the wisdom strand, reminding yourself that snapping at your family will just make your morning worse, that clear perspective automatically softens your intention.
The heat gets turned down just a fraction.
Exactly. Because the intention is softer, you are able to engage the ethics strand. You choose skillful speech and manage to communicate your stress without attacking anyone.
And here is the payoff. Because you didn't attack anyone, you don't spend the next 4 hours at work marinating in regret and defensive rationalizations. Your mental hull is clean.
Now, because the hull is clean, when you sit down to focus on a difficult task, your mental discipline strand actually works.
The boat isn't rocking.
Right. Your mind naturally settles into collectedness because it isn't fighting a storm of its own making.
The loop reinforces itself. The more collected your mind becomes, the clearer your perspective is the next time frustration hits. You've replaced a downward spiral of compulsion with an upward spiral of integration.
The ancient texts that the RAFT program draws from really capture this dynamic movement. There's a story mentioned called the Sadaka Sutta, often referred to as the acrobat.
Oh, can you walk us through that one?
It's a brilliant metaphor for the relationship between internal discipline and external harmony. The story features two acrobats who perform on a bamboo pole.
Okay.
The master tells the apprentice, "You watch out for me, and I'll watch out for you, and that way we'll safely perform our tricks."
Sounds reasonable.
But the apprentice wisely corrects him. The apprentice says, "No, master, you look after yourself, and I will look after myself. By each of us protecting our own balance, we protect each other, and we come down safely."
That completely flips the script on how we view self-improvement. By maintaining our own internal stability, our own collectedness and ethics, we fundamentally become a safer, more reliable presence for the people around us.
It destroys the idea that working on your own mind is a selfish act. And the text pairs this with the Mahakatarisaka Sutta, which explicitly outlines how these eight factors constantly circle and support one another.
Like the living loop.
Exactly. Skillful effort and skillful mindfulness are described as continually running around the other factors, adjusting and correcting the course. The raft is always moving, always requiring micro-adjustments.
So what does this all mean for you, the person listening to this right now? If you look at your own daily life, the most vital takeaway from this chapter is that the middle way never asks for your absolute perfection.
Because demanding perfection from yourself is just another form of that grim, punishing extreme It is unskillful.
The program simply asks for your honesty about where you are. It asks for a willingness to build a bit of steadiness. But most importantly, it asks for your willingness to notice when you've drifted off course and to gently return to the steering wheel.
Again and again.
And again. You do not fail the voyage when you drift. The act of noticing and returning is the voyage.
It redefines progress entirely. Progress is no longer an unbroken streak of perfect behavior. Progress is shortening the time between drifting and returning.
Before we wrap up this deep dive, we want to ensure you know how to access the full scope of this material. The concepts we explore today are pulled from Chapter 56, which is just one piece of the Comprehensive RAFT program. The RAFT to Freedom workbook is authored by Dr. Catherine Jacob and Vince Cullen.
It is a genuinely remarkable synthesis of ancient wisdom and modern pragmatism.
And the most remarkable part is the accessibility. The authors are making the entire 66-chapter workbook freely available online for anyone who needs it.
That's incredible.
It is. You can access the complete program by visiting their website at raft2freedom.org. It's shared under a Creative Commons license, which emphasizes attribution, non-commercial use, and sharing alike. They built this raft, and they are leaving it on the shore for anyone who needs to cross the river.
This raises an important question for you to experiment with today. We talked a lot about the spectrum of effort. Think about a difficult, perhaps tedious task you have to face later today.
Mm-hmm.
What would it actually look like to apply the minimum effective dose of effort to that task? Approach it without gripping the steering wheel so tightly your knuckles turn white, but also without throwing your hands up and being completely careless.
Find that balance.
Exactly. Find that precise, skillful middle gear. Try it and observe what it does to your energy levels by the end of the day.
I love that framing. Less brute force, more precise steering. It's about stepping off that exhausting pendulum and finally taking control of the raft. I want to leave you with a direct question from the text to mull over on your own. Do I secretly believe life shouldn't be this hard for me? What changes when I bring in a wider perspective of how things really are?
Don't worry about achieving. Don't worry about perfection. Just be there each moment as best you can.